This recording was made in Great Britain by the Medical Recording Service of the College of General Practitioners. The recording, editing and production by Dr. John and Dr. Valerie Graves. Copyright reserved. Otosclerotic deafness. The speaker is Mr. Philip Beals, consultant ear, nose and throat surgeon to the Royal Infirmary, Doncaster.
Since the beginning of the National Health Service in this country, at least 700,000 hearing aids have been issued to patients by the Ministry of Health. At the moment, about 50,000 hearing aids are being issued each year. Most patients will not use a hearing aid at all until their hearing level has fallen to such an extent that they cannot hear close conversation properly, and it is thus clear that these figures and will only relate to those people who are in fact quite hard of hearing. There must be many thousands of patients with hearing defects who are trying to hide their disability, whom we know nothing about. These figures give some indication of the very large numbers of people in Great Britain who have defective hearing and of the magnitude of the problem. Various surveys of the incidence of hearing defects have been carried out. Wilkins, in a social survey, found that in this country, 4% of the population admitted to some degree of deafness. Shambo, in 1933, found that in adults, otosclerosis was the cause of more than half their cases of deafness in the United States. These and other figures from many sources suggest that the incidence of deafness due to otosclerosis is about 0.5%, or 1 in 250 of the population. It is thus clear that we are not concerned with a rare condition, but rather a common one, and that every general practitioner will meet from time to time in his practice. Thus, in an average-sized practice of, say, 2,500 patients, there will be at least 10 patients with a hearing defect which is the result of otosclerosis. This disease is not in any way dangerous to life, but as the people affected by it begin to lose their hearing in early adult life, and as this hearing loss is usually progressive, it is most important for us to be able to recognize it and to know about the various methods of treatment which are available today. If you will look at the first diagram, slide number one, you will see a drawing of a section through the external auditory canal and tympanum. You will note the external ear, the tympanic membrane, and the auditory ossicles lying in the cavity of the middle ear. The stapes can be seen in the diagram as the smallest of the ossicles, and the oval window into which the stapes fits is clearly visible. This is the site that the abnormal deposits of bone form, which prevent the full movement of the stapes foot plate in the oval window niche. What is the cause of these abnormal deposits of bone which can give rise to such profound hearing loss in some patients? You will remember that the bony capsule of the labyrinth is fully developed in the fetus at term, and no further increase in its size takes place after birth. There is no other bone in the body in which this occurs. In the developing fetus, the otic capsule is cartilaginous. The cartilage is replaced by bone, and this replacement should be complete at birth. However, there are some areas of defective ossification which remain filled with cartilage, and one of these sites is just in front of the oval window. If new bone formation occurs at this site, it will involve the stapes foot plate, prevent it from moving normally, and hence cause a hearing defect. The predisposing and exciting causes of the new bone formation are not known, but there is probably some hormonal influence, as more than half the female patients with otosclerosis are made worse by pregnancy. Slide number two summarizes the above points, and you will note the familial incidence and the fact that 50% of female patients are made worse by pregnancy. The third slide summarizes the pathology of otosclerosis. The essential lesion in otosclerosis is the replacement of areas in compact bone of the labyrinth by spongy bone. In young adults, this new bone is vascular, but with increase of age, it loses its vascularity and becomes avascular. This is of clinical importance as the results of surgery are, for obvious reasons, likely to be better when the growth of the new bone has ceased, and this will be in the older age groups in the 30s or 40s. Slide number 4 shows the gross pathology of otosclerosis. The upper two photographs show early otosclerosis. Small deposits of new bone are present in the stapes footplate. Movement is interfered with and the patient has a conductive deafness. Although the deposits are small in this case, the patient was quite hard of hearing. The lower three photographs are from a case of advanced otosclerosis, and you can see that the whole of the stapes footplate has been replaced by abnormal bone and the footplate is grossly thickened. This patient had been hard of hearing for over 30 years and could only hear a loud voice at close contact with her ear. Both these patients have in fact had successful operations performed some years ago. Slide number 5 indicates the main clinical features of otosclerosis. The first symptom is deafness, and the onset of this is insidious, but it nearly always progresses. Usually both ears are affected, but the hearing of one ear is nearly always worse than that of the other. If one ear only is affected, the hearing loss is usually, but not always, due to another cause. Often the patient's only complaint is that she cannot hear well when there is a group of people talking or when in a theatre or cinema. Most patients with otosclerotic deafness can hear better when they are in noisy surroundings, such as on a bus or tube train. This ability may disappear in the course of time, and if it does so, it is an indication of the nerve deafness which complicates many cases of otosclerosis. Tinnitus, or noises in the ears or head, is not particularly common in otosclerosis, and when it is marked, there is usually an associated perceptive deafness. Slight postural vertigo is described as a common accompaniment of otosclerosis in some textbooks. This is uncommon in my experience, although I have seen many Ayer's disease associated with otosclerosis. The diagnosis of otosclerotic deafness is based on the history and clinical findings. The voice of the otosclerotic patient is characteristically soft, and it will not be raised to match any background noise as in the normal person. The voice of the patient with a nerve deafness must be contrasted, as here there is an alteration in its timbre and the speech is loud. The otosclerotic patient does not shout, as she can hear her own voice transmitted through the bones of the skull. If the eardrum of the patient is examined, it will appear to be absolutely normal, or it may show what is termed brilliant mint condition. The very clear and bright appearance of the drum in otosclerosis is due to an increased translucency with a slightly increased vascularity. The most valuable test of the hearing that the practitioner can carry out is the Rinne test. A 256 cycles per second tuning fork is struck and placed on the mastoid process. When it is found that the hearing of the tone by bone conduction is clear, whilst the hearing of the tone by air conduction is absent or diminished. Slide number 6 illustrates the differential diagnosis. This will include conductive deafness from other causes and perceptive deafness. Conductive deafness in adults may be caused by occlusion of the external auditory canal by cerumen deposits. These can usually be removed by syringing after the wax has been softened. In some cases, these deposits are of epithelial debris and are adherent to the drum and cannot be removed by simple measures. This condition is known as keratosis obturans, and it requires specialist treatment, which consists of removal of the deposits under anesthesia with microscopic control. Secretory otitis media causes conductive deafness, often of a marked degree. The clinical picture is of a sudden onset of deafness, which varies from day to day. Examination of the eardrum shows it to be dull, and a fluid level may be seen. The treatment consists of tympanic membrane puncture. If fluid escapes, the diagnosis will be confirmed. Hearing improves after this procedure, and the patient who entered the consulting room profoundly deaf leaves it a few moments later hearing normally. Chronic otitis media will be diagnosed by the history of discharge from the ear and examination of the drum, which will show a perforation. A scarred drum head may indicate that the deafness is due to an adhesive otitis, but it is often difficult to exclude otosclerosis in some of these patients, particularly if the deafness is profound. It may be necessary to carry out a tympanic exploration to confirm the diagnosis. Some cases of otosclerosis, particularly of the long-standing variety, present as cases of nerve deafness, and it may only be possible to make an accurate diagnosis after careful audiometric hearing tests have been carried out. If vertigo occurs in attacks associated with tinnitus and unilateral nerve deafness, Meniere's disease is the probable cause. Although this disease is usually seen in the older age group, it does occur in younger patients. The diagnosis can only be made by the otologist, and audiometric and caloric tests will be necessary. To summarize, if a young patient comes to the doctor with a history of difficulty of hearing of insidious onset, if the clinical examination of the eardrum shows it to be normal, and if the tuning fork is heard better by bone conduction than by air conduction, the diagnosis should be otosclerosis until proved otherwise. Otosclerotic deafness is an easy diagnosis to make if one is aware of the main features of it. In my experience, it is uncommon for the doctor who refers the case to the specialist to think of this diagnosis, and these patients are often treated for eustachian catarrh and only referred for a second opinion because the condition persists. There is no such condition as chronic eustachian catarrh in young adults, although it may be met with in children when it is secondary to an enlarged pad of adenoids. The term is a bad one, and it really dates from the days not so long ago when there was no treatment for otosclerosis, and so the doctor hesitated to tell the patient the real cause of the loss of hearing. What is the advice to be given to the patient with a hearing loss due to otosclerosis? She can be told that hearing can be improved by the provision of an electric hearing aid, or it can be restored by means of surgery. There is no medical treatment at present which will influence the course of the disease in any way at all. Hearing aids are of value in otosclerosis in most cases, but if a severe nerve deafness is associated, a hearing aid may be useless. One should remember that there has been great progress made in the design of hearing aids in recent years, and the present trend is to advise binaural hearing aids which can be very small or attached to spectacles. However, even the best hearing aids have certain disadvantages, as background noises are amplified and patients do not like admitting to others that they are deaf and need assistance with their hearing. Surgery has today much to offer in this condition, especially as there is some evidence, although not conclusive, that the newer surgical methods may arrest the loss of cochlear function, which is often associated with advanced otosclerosis. During the last few years, a revolutionary change has occurred in the surgical treatment of otosclerotic deafness. But before discussing the newer methods, it may be interesting to give a brief review of older operations. Until fairly recently, the fenestration operation was the standard surgical treatment for this form of deafness. In this operation, a new opening or window is made in the bone of the lateral semicircular canal, exposing, but not damaging, the membranous semicircular canal. The sound waves now travel across the middle ear and move the round window membrane. You will remember that the stapes is fixed in position. The new window acts as a relief valve. The perilymph can move again, and so the patient hears. The technique of this operation has been perfected over the last 20 years, and in the hands of the skilled and experienced operator, patients can gain good and lasting hearing improvement. About 70% of selected patients with otosclerosis can benefit from the fenestration operation. It has, however, certain disadvantages. Not only is it a major undertaking for the patient, but also, in a proportion of cases, there is difficulty in obtaining complete healing, and a persistent ear discharge may develop after operation. In some patients, vitiligo is troublesome afterwards. And further, the patient must not swim or dive after this operation. Normal hearing can never be produced by this procedure, as the acicular chain is not functioning. The operation is only possible in selected cases with good nerve function, and so those patients with long-standing deafness may be unsuitable for this form of surgery. In spite of these disadvantages, the fenestration operation has been tried for a long period and has produced some very good results. In 1953, Rosen of New York focused the attention of otologists throughout the world on an operation called mobilization of the stapes. This operation had been tried before in 1890 by Mio, but it had been given up as it proved to be dangerous in the age before antibiotics. This operation is based on the theory that if the stapes footplate, fixed in the oval window by otosclerotic deposits, is freed by fracturing the deposits, it will move again normally, and there will be no union between the fragments of fractured bone. The operation is a minor one, both for the patient and the surgeon. It is quite safe, and it produces a striking hearing improvement in many cases. However, this initial hearing gain is lost in 2 out of every 3 patients. And my own experience over the last few years leads me to believe that lasting hearing improvement has only been obtained in patients of the older age group with a moderate degree of deafness that has been slow in onset. The majority of surgeons experienced in the treatment of otosclerosis have given up the operation of mobilization of the stapes, as if it is not successful, it may be more difficult to use one of the newer techniques on the same patient. In 1958, John Shea of Memphis introduced a more radical operation for dealing with the fixed foot plate of otosclerosis. He removed the stapes completely, exposing the vestibule of the inner ear. The open oval window was then closed with a vein graft taken from the back of the hand. The gap between the incus and the vein graft covering the oval window was then closed with a tiny piece of polythene tubing running from the lenticular process of the incus to touch the vein graft. A similar operation to this is carried out by another American surgeon called Schuchnecht, but here stainless steel wire is used instead of polythene. This type of operation can give astonishing hearing improvement and can literally transform the life of the patient and alter the whole personality almost overnight. Furthermore, nearly all cases of otosclerosis, even the most advanced, with profound hearing loss, can be treated in this way. However, in both the Shea and the Schuchnecht operations, the continued hearing of the patient is dependent on the piece of polythene tubing or the piece of wire remaining in the middle ear in the same position as it was placed originally. Experience has shown that although it usually does stay in position, it does not always do so. Sudden jolts of the head, head injuries, and so on can dislodge the foreign body. Also, as the blood supply to the incus has been damaged by this operation, the tip of the incus may necrose later on. The plastic strut can ulcerate through the vein graft and give rise to sudden deafness or severe vertigo after an apparently successful result. For these reasons, and because on general surgical principles one should avoid foreign bodies if possible, some surgeons have developed techniques in which no foreign material at all is introduced into the middle ear, except in the rare case with abnormal anatomy. I have developed an operation of this type myself. If you will put on slide number 7, it shows the surgical approach to the middle ear. The operation is carried out under a general anesthetic through an oral speculum. The slide shows the incision which is made through the speculum. Slide number 8 shows that the eardrum has been reflected forwards and part of the tympanic contents can now be seen. You will see the incus and the stapedius tendon, and beyond that the stapes. The quarter tympani nerve has been turned forward out of the way. Slide number 9 shows the tympanic cavity completely exposed, and you will see in this slide the foot plate of the stapes, the round window, the pyramid, and the stapedius tendon. Slide number 10 shows the otosclerotic deposit very clearly at the anterior end of the foot plate of the stapes. You will see the masses of heaped up bone fixing the stapes in position. The mucous membrane has been scraped away from around the foot plate, and also the crura of the stapes have been detached from the foot plate and turned out of the way to lie on the promontory. You also see the facial nerve in its relation to the foot plate of the stapes. We now turn to slide number 11. The fixed foot plate is now being removed. In this case, a hook is being used. In some cases, the surgeon drills a hole into the center of the fixed foot plate. This is necessary if it is very thickened. Slide number 12 shows that the foot plate has been removed, and you can see the vestibule of the inner ear, which of course contains the perilymph. Using a fine instrument, tiny fragments of bone are being removed from around the margins of the oval window. Slide number 13 shows the preparation of the vein graft, which is being used to replace the fixed foot plate. A small piece of subcutaneous vein is taken from the back of the hand. Fat is trimmed away from it, and a tiny piece of venous tissue is obtained, just a little larger than the foot plate of the stapes. Slide number 14 shows the application of the vein graft to close the oval window. It is applied on a special applicator, and as you will see in slide number 15, the oval window has now been closed by the vein graft. This is soft tissue and it replaces the fixed rigid foot plate. If you now turn to slide number 16, you will see that the crura of the stapes, which were turned out of the way, have now been replaced to lie on top of the vein graft. Sound waves can now enter the internal ear, being transmitted from the eardrum through the auditory ossicles and through the vein graft into the inner ear. The final stage is to replace the eardrum in position, and a small pack of absorbable material is placed in the ear. The patient lies in bed quite still for 24 hours, but it is usually possible to discharge them 4 or 5 days later. Slide number 17, the final slide, shows the operating microscope, which is used in all these operations. The surgeon works at a magnification from 6 to 25 diameters, and without this instrument it would not be possible to carry out this type of surgery. The principle of the operation is quite a simple one, but you will appreciate that it is quite a difficult technical exercise. Although this operation, which I call the platinectomy operation, which means removal of the foot plate and vein grafting of the oval window, which is applying the vein graft to close the oval window after the foot plate is removed, although this operation is a more difficult technique than the Shay or the Schuchneck operations, it is a completely physiological operation, and it can be used in nearly all cases of otosclerotic deafness. Results are excellent, and the operation possesses none of the potential disadvantages of the techniques using foreign material. Some surgeons believe that a method such as this is the operation of the future for otosclerosis. There are certain risks attached to all these new operations on the stapes, and it is essential that both the patient and the practitioner should be aware of them. In all these techniques, the vestibule of the inner ear is opened when the stapes foot plate is removed. The vestibule of the inner ear contains the delicate nervous structures concerned with balance, and these structures also communicate with the cochlea. Damage to the vestibular apparatus and the cochlea can be produced by the operation, or an aseptic labyrinthitis can occur sometime after operation, and this may produce vertigo or even a nerve deafness, which may be partial or complete. In skilled hands, these complications are fortunately rare, between 3 and 4%. but in the hands of the occasional operator, the incidence of such complications may rise to 15% or more. The patient must always be told of the possibility of the hearing being made worse or of a persistent vitiligo developing after operation, and must be prepared to accept this risk, which is a small one. We always advise an operation on the worst ear as the first step, and a second operation on the other ear should never be advised unless the first operation has produced no untoward result. Delayed damage to the cochlear and vestibular apparatus can occur months after the techniques using the foreign material, and it may be due to it ulcerating into the vestibule through the thin vein graft. Such complications are unlikely to be seen after the method of platinectomy, which I use as no foreign body is present. Over 80% of patients achieve a good and lasting hearing improvement after the operation you have seen. More time will be necessary before one can assess the long-term results of this new kind of surgery. But one should remember that there are few surgical operations which give such a high success rate with so few complications, and there is little doubt that with increasing experience the results will get even better. The patient who undergoes one of these operations does not have an alarming experience. Operations are carried out under general anesthesia, and the patient remains in hospital for 3 or 4 days. Transient slight vitiligo is experienced for a day or two after operation, but it is seldom troublesome and no special treatment is usually needed. After operation, the patient should lead a quiet life for at least 3 weeks. Many patients are so pleased with their improved hearing, they try to embark on a round of social activities after operation, and this can cause trouble as the sensitive contents of the vestibule of the inner ear have been exposed and need time to settle down. Sexual activity should be avoided until the third post-operative week is over. I advise patients who travel by air to go home if possible after the third post-operative week. In conclusion, I would like to quote the words of a patient of mine, a young woman of 34 years, who had been deaf since the age of 19. "I can hear things larger than life. The gurgle of the bath water sounds like an express train. The alarm clock is like a fire alarm. The click of a switch, clapping, and the pitter-patter of bare feet is like people running around in clogs. Please don't shout when you talk. It is wonderful to hear again, but it is almost deafening. I suppose I will get used to it. I am discovering a new world of noise."
We should like to thank Smith, Klein and French Laboratories Limited for their generosity in paying for the cost of this recording. This recording was produced by the Medical Recording Service of the College of General Practitioners.